and welcome to the Scottish Song Guide with the Sorries. We're back at last. I am Douglas.
I'm Marty. I bet everyone was waiting with bated breath for us to do another podcast.
Yeah, we're back and we're going to do a series of podcasts. So this is the first one and we're really chuffed, I think, to be back doing this. So we hope you enjoy it. And today we are going to be looking at the song Come Ye by Athol. Mountains, they follow Prince Jeremy. Follow ye, follow ye, wayward never follow ye. Long have ye loved us and trusted us fairly. Cherly, cherly, wayward never follow ye. King of Eland hearts, bonny Prince Jeremy.
So, obviously, the clue is in the name in terms of a bit of a geographical location. But the first thing that occurs to me is, clearly, Doug, your family have a bit of history from Athol. Is that how you first came to the song?
It was in a sense that, as you say, because of the family connection to that area of Athol, which is sort of between Dunkeld and Blair Athol, very roughly in Perthshire. Because of that, I was always attracted to it. You know, that came from being very young and, you know, loving Killiecrankie because I knew where Killiecrankie was and so on. And hearing it in song was always a bit of a thrill. This song, though, I came to quite a bit later. And I think it was the Corrie's version of it that I first heard. And it wasn't that it was a particularly well-known song in their repertoire, but I just really enjoyed it. And I think we did this fairly early on, am I right in thinking?
We did, I think, yeah, absolutely. Because I didn't really know the song when you sort of said, oh, we should do this one.
Yeah, I think perhaps in the early days it was one of the ones that I knew a bit better. So as we tended to do when we were first playing shows and had to get a lot of songs in the set, the one that knew it best would generally play guitar and sometimes the other one would play Baran on it, and that's what we did. So yeah, we had a guitar Baran arrangement of it first.
Yeah, that's right.
Then later we came to have a double Baran arrangement. We actually opened some shows, I think, at the Fringe with that.
I think we probably did. We used to certainly always do a double Baran opener.
Yeah,
because I'm much more comfortable with the version we do now. I like it a lot more.
Yeah, which is two guitars.
Yeah, that's right. But there's the kind of it's the harmony. When you hit the harmonies in this version of that we're doing of it, I think is really interesting. But I can't remember when we started doing that. If we started doing that because it was just bods, so we wanted to make it a bit more interesting, or whether we did that from the very start. It's obviously I should have prepared a bit more for the podcast.
as with everything in life, Marty.
Well, indeed. By Athol, lad, we the fill a bag. Down by the tummel, our banks o' the Garry, saw ye the lads with their bonnets and white cockats, down from the mountains to follow Prince Jerry.
So, Marty, it's obviously a Jacobite song. Do you want to give us a bit of the theme of the song? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is a Jacobite song, but of course there's more than one kind of Jacobite song, and there's a few different uprisings. There's the 15 and the 45, 1715, 1745, in case people don't know. And there was also one in 1719, although it was much more minor and got snuffed out pretty early.
For people that really don't know, the Jacobite uprisings, those uprisings were basically trying to get the Stuart kings back on the throne of Britain and Ireland.
Yeah. Yeah, the King James. Jacobus is Latin for James, so that's where the Jacobite name comes from. And this is an attempt to return them. Some people think it was an attempt to restore a Catholic monarchy, but it's not as simple as that, because it's not kind of Catholic versus Protestants. It's not like that. Or at least not as simple as that. So anyway, this one is set at the start of the Jacobite Rising. Some people seem to think that Come Ye by Athol is sort of set when it's all about sending out the emissaries to try and raise the clans. And it certainly seems to have a bit of that going on a bit with it. It says, you know, it has Come Ye by Athol, lad with the fillabeg, down by the tummel or banks of the Garry. These are the two rivers in Athol. Saw ye my lad with his bonnet and white cockade, leaving his mountains to follow Prince Charlie, it says. It's not quite the way we sing it, because as the oral tradition kicks in, you hear it and you sing it and you hear it and you sing it. And actually, unless you go back to the original or a written version of the original, you end up sort of distancing it just a little bit. But that's fine, because that's the way that folk tradition works.
Of course, yeah.
So there's a list of people which the speaker talks about. He's wishing health to MacDonald and gallant Clanranald. These are the men I would trust with my Charlie. Or sometimes these are the men that will die for their Charlie. There's also Glengarry. And these are early adherents to Bonnie Prince Charlie. As is Lochiel Appin, is probably Charles Stuart of Ardshiel. Down by Lord Murray, Lord George Murray ended up taking general control of the Jacobite armies after September 1745.
He, of course, is the figure that is sort of always presented as being opposed to Charlie, the one that wanted to bring the Jacobites back north from Derby.
Yeah.
And also there was some dispute over the choosing of Drumossie Moor as the battlefield for Culloden as well.
Yeah, and also he put the MacDonald's nose out of joint by nudging them out of the right-hand side of the line and insisting that they take the left, which didn't really help either. But there was a lot of politics going on, as I'm sure there are in every large army. But I think the other one that's worth mentioning is Roy O'Kildarley, which I've seen some references saying, oh, maybe this is Rob Roy MacGregor, which would be absolutely fine, except for the fact that he'd been dead for about 9 years by this point. So I think it's quite unlikely. He was out in the 15. By the time it was the 45, he was long gone. It's more likely that Roy O'Kildarley is one of the Stuarts, who was a sort of a soldier poet. That seems to be one of the other targets that people seem to think is quite likely, and it strikes me that that's probably right. Glengarry is also an interesting one, because Glengarry was led by the younger son during most of the campaign, until he was accidentally killed after the Battle of Falkirk. And his big brother had come back to try and join up, but he was captured. He was captured and chucked in the Tower of London, and he was eventually released in 1747. But he's thought to have been one of the key government spies in the Jacobite camp after the 45 rebellion. Andrew Lang, the historian, identified him as Pickle the Spy. So that's Alistair Roux, I think. So that's the sort of younger Glengarry.
Well, again, it was one of the great habits of the Jacobite uprisings to split your allegiances according to your sons.
Yeah, that's right.
Spread your bets, as it were.
I'm not sure if it counts as spreading your bets, having one of them killed in Falkirk after a battle, another one knocked up in the locked up in the Tower of London.
But
I take your point.
I have but one son, my gallant young Donald, but had I 10, they would follow Prince Charlie, healthy MacDonald and gallant Clanranald. These are the men I would trust with my Charlie.
The broad slant of the thing is just basically talking about who's joining up with the Jacobites and how brilliant they all are. So that's the dates. We're talking 1745. But then, of course, this is not a song that was written in 1745, right? So I wonder, Doug, can you talk a little bit about when it was published?
Yeah, it was published first, and something we haven't mentioned, although we know it as Come Ye by Athol, it was originally published under the title Charlie. So that was in 1819. It was published in a collection called A Border Garland, which was subtitled Nine New Songs by James Hogg, the music partly old, partly composed by himself and friends. So this is the collection that it first appeared in, as I say, along with eight other songs. So basically around about the same time that Hogg's Jacobite Relics, or the first volume of Hogg's Jacobite Relics, appeared. And the song was obviously popular from the offset, because it appeared in lots of song sheets during the 1820s. There was one I saw which was great from 1825. The titles on these old song sheets are brilliant. By that point, the title has changed to Bonnie Prince Charlie, and it's entitled Bonnie Prince Charlie, as sung with the most distinguished applause by Miss Noel. and there are various other ones that it appears in. But then it comes again in a song collection in 1831, when Hogg's Songs by the Ettrick Shepherd is published. So it appears there again under the title Bonnie Prince Charlie. And Hogg has quite a note on it there, but the great takeaway from his note there is his he opens his note with him. Is it not singular how this song should have been so popular? There can be no dispute that it is one of my worst. So obviously,
do you think he was fishing for compliments there, or do you think he was just being sort of self-deprecating?
Well, it's all right fishing for compliments if you're speaking to someone, but there's not much point doing it in print because any payback you get is usually takes a while. So yeah, but you could obviously be self-deprecating there. Do you want to give us just a brief sort of? We mentioned that the words are by James Hogg. We'll come to the tune in a little minute. But do you want to maybe tell us a little bit about Hogg and who he was for those people that don't know?
Well, Hogg is a Scottish... he's a shepherd. He called himself the Ettrick Shepherd. And he was taught to write by another shepherd. And he didn't have very much formal education at all. His father was also a shepherd. He was a tenant farmer. So Hogg's born in 1770, and when he's about 7 or 8 years old, unfortunately, there's a change in the price of beasts, and Hogg's father's business collapses, and he loses the tenancy, and basically they're destitute, effectively. And a neighbour takes the rent on a nearby farm and installs his father as his shepherd. But at that point, Hogg gets pulled out of formal education. And he's in formal education so little, even initially, that when asked, the school teacher who actually taught him couldn't remember him ever having been in school at all. But he's born in 1770. He dies in 1835, so he's about 65 when he dies. And he dies partly, it's thought, of as a result of a curling accident.
Oh.
He falls through the ice and becomes... And, you know, obviously gets an absolute soaking. And it's thought that he never really properly recovers from this. One of his curling stones is apparently in the museum in Dumfries. I'll need to go and have a look at it one day, but I've not been there yet.
Yeah, we should say, Marty is a curler, so he's fascinated by anything curling related. Yeah.
This is curling with stones on ice as opposed to with hair.
Yeah. Curler.
Anyway. Anyway, so the thing about that is that actually he's, throughout his life, he's quite proud of his sporting prowess. His grandfather on his mother's side, he was supposed to be the last man in the Borders to speak with the fairies. Willow Faulk was his name. But he was also a noted sportsman, and he said he ran races all over the Borders and he never ever lost. And Hogg himself claimed that he only once lost, and that was by the width of a heel. He's quite a big, strong bloke, and he enjoys that kind of physicality. He plays on the rustic thing, but there's a lot about Burns. When he first encounters Burns and hears about Burns, it's on Tam O'Shanter, this kind of supernatural poem that Burns writes, and Hogg is just blown away by this idea. Learns the poem outright and is suddenly really into the idea of being a poet, although there's quite a lot of evidence that he'd been writing before that. But at that point, he says, he decided to be a poet. And he also claims that he shared a birthday with Robert Burns on the date, which actually is probably not true, but it's not necessarily that Hogg was deliberately lying about that. It's possibly just that he didn't know. There's some debate about when he was actually born, the year of 1770, but he's not absolutely sure about when it was, which is not that unusual for that period.
No.
So, yeah, so he... Hogg tries to be a shepherd. It doesn't work out quite so well. He meets Scott, starts helping Scott with collecting border minstrelsy and a few of the songs for that. Hogg's mother is the one that gives Scott into trouble for writing down these orally transmitted songs and says that he's ruined them. And Hogg himself, that's kind of where he starts, the songwriting and the poetry. Taught himself to play the violin, and eventually Hogg moves up about the sort of just about 1810, 1811. He moves up to Edinburgh and tries to become a professional writer. But Hogg becomes one of the great Scottish novelists.
Yeah.
He's a very, very influential and important writer, James Hogg.
And at the time of his death, Wordsworth wrote extempore effusion upon the death of James Hogg. And he said, "The mighty minstrel breathes no longer. Mid mouldering ruins low he lies. and death upon the braes of Yarrow has closed the shepherd poet's eyes. So verses.
He's part of the literary scene.
Yeah, but Wordsworth wrote those beautiful words about him. But he then said he was undoubtedly a man of original genius, but of coarse manners and low and offensive opinions.
Yeah, well that's the thing. Scott says some quite strange stuff as well about him, and says that at one stage when he hands over one of Hogg's earliest book collections, he says, you know, to the Countess of Buccleuch, you know, you won't find very much to interest you here, because he's got enough talent to make him bad at being a shepherd, but sadly not enough to make him a good writer. But you know, there's all sorts of back and forth. They have a really interesting and complex relationship. Scott and Hogg were both interested in collecting and kind of modifying these tunes, but they weren't so interested in writing the tunes themselves, although, as I said, Hogg was a decent fiddle player by all accounts. So can you talk a little bit about the tunes and the way that the tune was attached to the words?
Yeah, well, some of these songs, the tunes are older, the words are put to older tunes. As the subtitle of A Border Garland said, where this song first appeared, you know, the music partly old, partly composed by himself and friends. But in A Border Garland, the song Charlie, as Camille Biatho was originally called, has a note saying, "Air by a friend of the editor." But it's later on that Hogg says, again in 1831 in his collection Songs by the Ettrick Shepherd, it's there that he says, "The air was given me by my friend, the late Mr. Neil Gow, and to it I dashed down the words at random." And then his note goes on to state that a Mr. Robertson assured him that the air was Gala Water. So that's not unusual at the time, the tune being attributed to someone, but being based on an older tune. There was a kind of strange, by modern standards, there was a strange relationship to claiming composition rights to tunes back in the 18th and 19th century. People claimed that they hadn't written things which they had done, claimed that they had written things which were actually old tunes that they'd basically just lifted and changed a little bit.
Yeah, well, Hogg's right in the middle of all of that. And it's just, there's these kind of fictions and that idea of who's written what, and it's not quite so pertinent, I think.
As I say, it's Hogg says that the tune was written by Neil Gow. Now, this Neil Gow is Neil Gow Jr. He's a grandson of the more famous Neil Gow, who was the Perthshire fiddler, responsible for a lot of the country dance repertoire, even today. His patron was the Duke of Atholl. This is the older Neil Gow. And his son, Nathaniel Gow, was also a great fiddler, great composer, and a publisher. And it was his son, Neil Gow Jr., that was said to have written this tune. By the time that Neil Gow was writing the tune, Neil Gow Jr., he was living in Edinburgh, as was Nathaniel Gow, had a publishing house in Princes Street in the centre of Edinburgh. And Neil Gow Jr., although not as renowned as a musician, he had that classic Enlightenment breadth of interest, because he was a composer, he was a publisher as well, but he was also a medical doctor, and he fitted that into 28 years because he died young as well.
So was the tune attached to the text initially, or was it one of those ones where they just say, "Oh, this is the tune, you need to go and find it"?
No, the tune...
If you know what I mean, or was it actually printed?
It was printed in A Border Garland. The tune and the words appeared together.
Right.
And actually in Songs by the Ettrick Shepherd, the 1831 collection, in that, Hogg states that arrangement is, I think he says it, is probably the best arrangement. So
right.
We mentioned earlier that it appeared in all these song sheets,
yeah.
But Hogg stuck with that original arrangement in its original publication.
Yeah, because one of the versions of this song is actually like a truncated version. It has two large verses, as opposed to having the whole lot.
Yeah,
and the wording is very slightly different, which is why when Hogg says things like, you know, "I just dashed down the words," you think, Aye, right, so you did. Because there's too much going on there. I don't believe him.
I'll go to Lochiel and up in a kneel to them, down by Lord Murray and Royal Kildarley. Brave Mackintosh, he will fly to the field with them.
So I hope you've enjoyed our little tour through Come Ye by Athol, or Bonnie Prince Charlie, however you want to call it. It's more normally Come Ye by Athol now. Hope you've, if you take away nothing else from this podcast, maybe you'll take that away. And I hope you feel a little bit more informed, if indeed you weren't already, about Hogg and his songwriting, and indeed the Jacobite themes of the song. There's a fantastic website in the James Hogg research in the University of Stirling, and they're in the midst of kind of publishing and republishing old scholarly versions of Hogg's works. But there's some great free resources on there at the University of Stirling website if you're interested.
And I should also say that through that you can access, obviously you should be listening to our versions of these songs, but there are James Hogg songs recorded by Sheena Wellington and Kirsten McHugh as well, which you can hear examples of in there.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for listening, and we shall speak to you again soon.
Yeah.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.